Okay, everyone. So welcome to this other session. Right now we're going to have Gwen Isaac presenting on transforming language revitalization through museum collections.
Thank you. It's an honor to be here. And I'm also really impressed that people here Sunday morning still have conference stamina. I was expecting to talk to an audience of about 3 or 4 people and we would just sit around the computer and chat, but I'm very impressed that actually people are still going. So I'll introduce myself and then start with the background on my research. So I've been working in the Pueblo communities in the Southwest region of the US for about 20 years. I'm a cultural anthropologist. I focus on knowledge systems. And the Pueblos are of a great interest to anthropologists in a lot of ways. One, because they were one of the first communities that were studied by anthropologists. So in 1879, one of the first US expeditions goes out to Zuni, and Frank Hamilton Cushing remains there for another 4 years. And he studies the language, he collects pottery, he learns and documents the mythology. And these are still considered really key moments within the history of anthropology. So I had an interest in working in Zuni, also because the Smithsonian had returned photographs to the Pueblo. They had duplicated them, and so we had these comparable collections where you had photographs in DC and photographs in Zuni, and so I really wanted to look at the different ways people were going to think about, use, and contextualize these historic documents. But soon after I arrived in Zuni, it became clear that one of the most interesting things that was happening in Zuni at the time was the development of a tribal museum. So my research became about how the museum was having to mediate between the Euro-American knowledge system, which is based on a right to know. So you can come, you can listen to me, and I don't ask any of you in the audience whether it's okay to get the knowledge that I'm giving you. I don't sort of vet you. Within Zuni, it's much more designed on a need to know. You make sure it's tailor-made to the person, it's tailor-made to the context. And when I refer to that, it's largely within the esoteric religious societies that I'm referring to. So you do have a hierarchical system of knowledge in Zuni, but a lot of what I was trying to look at was the tension between a system that was in some ways quite exclusive within Zuni and the Euro-American system, which is that everyone has the right to this knowledge. And of course, at the Smithsonian, we have to deal with this because we have esoteric records. So just to kind of give you a background, that I think about different ways in which we contextualize our knowledge. So I've now taken on, I'm the curator for North American ethnology at the Smithsonian, at the National Museum of Natural History. The collections there, the ethnographic collections, 70% of them in North America. So it's quite an undertaking. Just from my experience working with the Zuni collections, the sort of scope and size of the collection is not reflected in the number of tribal members accessing them. So it's my job to kind of open up and get more people working on the collection. So that's, you know, that's where I come in. So we've also, in order to do that, we've started a program called Recovering Voices, which is the initiative is designed to forge new methods, partnerships, collaboration with communities and scholars in an interdisciplinary network. With the idea that we're going to help provide resources, support, and research towards language revitalization and, within my area, really knowledge revitalization. So I don't work within linguistics, but a lot of the times when we are working with communities, there's as much knowledge revitalization that's going on at the same time, especially when these collections, as I say, come from a point in time where there was a lot of social change. And they may be some of the largest representations of a particular practice that people can then sort of revisit and talk about. Okay, so what are the important criteria that I have to deal with in terms of developing the methodology within these consultations with the communities? So the first is the context. Well, I think museums are really important. Museums provide an immense diverse set of knowledges. We have the comprehensive knowledge system, which the science, and the natural historians within the museum follow with the idea that everything can fit into that system. So we have that system. But then we also have all of these other cultural knowledge systems. Every community that we're working with will have a different sort of hierarchy and structure of how they want their knowledge represented, and that's also going to affect how we interpret the collections. And then also the scope. In terms of the sort of temporal scope, it's really, really important. I think a lot of people who are working with communities, if you're not in touch with museums and archives and so forth, you may not get a sense of change that's taken place. And so museums have an important role, I think, to play there. And then the dynamic. I'm particularly interested in the production of knowledge and the circulation of knowledge and how that takes place. And so this project, the methodology has to think very carefully about what are the factors that go into that. Okay, so let's talk about things. Oftentimes, I think people see museums as having shelves of objects, and there really aren't relationships between the people and the objects. A sort of a useful anecdote of this project, I'm working with Hopi on an oral tradition project about the pottery. So we're both collecting the linguistic and the knowledge context of these materials. I spent, we raised $40,000 to get every single pot, and we're talking, and then again, the size of the collections are huge. This could be 3,000 pots that I get photographed. But just recently in Hopi, the people I'm working with said, well, no, we want to use the photographs from our last visit. And yes, there were only about 200-300 pots represented. And so we were talking about it, and they showed me the photographs, and they're all holding the pots. So you have a person holding the pot. So you have an image that represents this relationship between the person and the object. So that's really, to sort of encapsulate, those are the photographs they want to use. They don't want some sterile image, because they're going to be interviewing the potters, and they don't want to just show them, here's a pot. But to show them a picture of them holding the pot, much more meaningful. So this is when I get, this idea of relational knowledge, knowledge networks. So relational knowledge, when we think about that within Recovering Voices, it's really trying to get at both interdisciplinary knowledge. We need the linguists and the cultural anthropologists to be able to come together and see how the knowledge relates, that and the language aspects. So it's both a disciplinary relationship, but then also you have within the communities, and I could sort of give more anecdotes too, we have lots of cases where an expert has been brought in from a community and is being interviewed about a particular kind of object, but it turns out when we're recording her and her husband speaking in their language, that's actually much more meaningful. So if she's just telling us about the object, that's one thing. But to actually record the conversations taking place within the language amongst the family members, we're finding is much more useful. And then again, this comes back to knowledge networks. So if you're trying to re-engage these collections back into a community, they belong to quite a complex network. So, to sort of be able to start documenting that and thinking about it, there's a lot for us to learn, I think, about how this works. Okay, so the oral tradition project at Hopi. Hopi is another Pueblo within the Southwest, so it's close to my heart because it's in the area of the world that I specialize in. And Hopi, again, was one of the first communities that one of these expeditions went to, and so our collections are vast, and they really need a contemporary relationship now with the community. And at the same time, a number of people have said to me, Lee Kuanishima, who's the head of cultural preservation, is saying, I'm really concerned. I feel like the kids are learning the pottery, but they don't get some of the social values that go with the pottery. So can we sort of really explore this and have you guys help us, because the collections will start to bring in some of these aspects. So we've started this project. We have Karen Charlie, who is here, and this was a important moment. We had Karen Charlie and Valerie Cahe, who are both potters. Karen is more one of more senior potters from First Mesa, and Valerie is a, you could say, young potter And so the idea also was that we were going to deal with intergenerational transmission of knowledge, and that we think it's really important when we have these visits that you have a range of ages and that people are talking to each other. So it's not just to us, but they're able to get, you know, a number of people involved within the community. So so this was in 2012. We spent a week going through all the collections, and this was one of the highlights. Karen had taken, she's a specialist in canteens, she makes canteens, and she picked up the canteens, and she's sitting there, and she sticks her hand in the canteens, and she said, oh, these really large ones are constructed completely differently than how I was taught. And she goes through this process of deconstructing how these were made. And it was, you know, for us it was really important, and it was also important for her, that there is this, you know, there's a change in the structures, you know. So these are kind of exciting moments. And she was able to look at various things. She does these water jars with sort of these corn maidens, and enabled to actually hold the object. She's saying, oh, you know, the chin's actually constructed completely differently. And now I'm able to understand actually why the older ones have survived and the ones we make break, you know, if you don't, you know. So there, so the community members are telling us, you know, museums have really focused on disseminating a lot of photographs and this idea of kind of digital repatriation. But if you're not working with the actual objects, there really is a sort of a gap in the way in which you're able to connect to some of the knowledge that's involved. Okay, so here's some of the participants in the project. We have Valerie Cahe, Leah McChesney, who's been working on pottery for about 30 years in the Pueblos, and Karen, Charlie, and myself. And we also videotape all the consultations. I think, you know, certainly all of you linguists out there will understand that. I mean, it would be nice in a way just to kind of spend time with people and not have the pressure of videotaping it. But because we're interested in documenting language, you really do, you know, we're finding, not only do we videotape it, we have to be logging and filing these things in a really constructive way while we're going, so that, because the community members very quickly afterwards say, I need that, I want to work with some kids at the schools using these materials. So, you know, there's a quite a fast turnaround for the request for stuff. So one of the things that came out on the pottery project was this, you know, the social role of the pottery. And there's some very powerful relationships that are formed with the pottery. A lot of the language refers to them as children. They speak, you know, when you sort of ping a pot, if it sings, it's a good pot. You know, wet clay being fired is the smell of rain in the desert, which again is about fertility. And so there's a lot of really, really rich cultural material that are held within these objects that are collected within the Hopi language, become very meaningful to the people who are able to come and work with the objects. So that's kind of been the process that we're doing within the museum. So then we moved on to develop a fieldwork aspect of this, and this is an image of Karen and Valerie, who've kitted themselves out with their backpacks and their tape recorders, and they were so excited. I'm not in Hopi. This is a cell phone photograph. They're sending this to me. But we're now in the process of funding Karen and Valerie to do interviews themselves with the potters, which we really feel is the most appropriate way to go. It'll be in their language. It'll be peer-to-peer. So Karen will be interviewing the elder potters, Valerie will be interviewing the younger potters, and they've set this up. This is what they've requested, because they're saying there's so much change in the way in which the values are within the pottery. The Karen's generation, when she sells the pot, she buys cattle. She does not want money. She feels like that is a sort of dissonance with the value of pottery. Pottery is supposed to be about emotional relationships, not about money. Within the younger generation, unfortunately, there's all this pressure from the traders in Santa Fe who say, I want this pot, I want it on Saturday, I want it for this show, and they are producing on demand, and it's very stressful. And they're telling the sort of the community that they are finding this a sort of, you know, a difficult process. And then there's not necessarily an understanding within Hopi of how to help the younger generations, because the elder generation don't even see the pottery within that framework. So we think the peer interviews will be an interesting way. Okay, so then, so the last project I'm going to talk about is GRASAC, Great Lakes Research Alliance for the Study of Aboriginal Cultures. This has been a project that's been ongoing for a very long time. It's based in Carleton University with Ruth Phillips, who's an art historian. But I've known her for a long time, and so we set up this visit. We have Myna and Ted Toulouse, who are from Manitou Island. So this is an Ojibwe community, Al Corbier and Marianne Corbier. And the really sort of the important part of this project was that the group that came together, there was about seven people. We had Rand Valentine from University of Wisconsin, who's a linguist, Ruth Historian, who is a art historian, Al Corbier, who is a historian and largely deals with wampum and the idea of the legal history of his community. Myna is an expert in quill baskets, and she called us and said, you know, I don't have a passport, I've got all these issues, I don't like flying, you know, but I want to come visit, can I bring my husband? And we said, of course. And actually, Ted turned out to be the person who collects all the materials, he collects the quills, he collects the birch bark. So that had never been communicated, but it was fantastic because the two of them spoke Anishinaabewin for 5 days straight, it's all on tape. And Rand, at the end of it, said, I've never heard such rich cultural material in the sort of 20 years that I've been working in this community. So it was this turning point for everyone in the group that because they were going in and they were looking at certain kinds of canoes, certain kinds of birch bark, that really were not, that they were from their childhood, that are not in the sort of communities today, there was this ability to kind of re-engage with this kind of knowledge. So we are now documenting all of this, trying to get a handle on the methodology, and we have some more groups coming in from the Northwest Coast in about a month, and I'm already sort of emailing and calling and saying, you know, make sure that each person, because at one point this particular group that's coming was going to have one language speaker from each group, and I was saying, no, please bring, you know, sort of families, bring, you know, speaking groups, because museums, I think, have really failed in this. I think they've gone for the solitary expert. You know, they've flown in the sort of the expert potter and so forth. And then it's really a kind of a difficult journey for that individual to try and tell the stories when really they're not being communicated within the community. So this is to kind of think about this. And what I was finding, and is the most important lesson for me as someone who deals with knowledge systems, is that we're starting to understand collective knowledges. There's a huge amount of diversity in the way in which the language is embodied by each speaker. And there's a lot of conversation with the objects of like, well, would you call it this or would you call it that? You know, do you want to say this? Do you want to say that? You know, I remember it being this. And so there's, you know, this is ongoing. And for linguists, this is, you know, general practice in how the knowledge is collected, but I think from a cultural anthropological perspective, it's a really useful methodological environment where we can think about the way in which people confer, defer, you know, give authority to someone or take authority away from someone, and the way in which they're building, and then at the end when they're finished and they've finished with the object, there is now a collective knowledge about that object. This is also going on in Zuni, where I do work. They have a similar project where all the elders have now said, we do not want you to ask us to come in by ourselves. We want to come in as a group. We want to make a decision about what the meaning of this object is and the language, you know, around it. So I think, you know, I think we have a lot to learn about this because a lot of anthropologists like the sole informant. So this changes that. So just to summarize, I feel as though really overall what we're having to learn is it's not what the particular knowledge is. Of course we document that. Of course we put it into historical perspective and we make sure that it is held for future generations. But what we're really having to learn is the context in which this stuff is transmitted. So it's important to also do the field work. I think having Karen and Val out there doing it the way they want to do it, asking the questions they want to ask, is going to be very informative. But we're also, I think, really at a stage now where we can think about not just what, but how. So, thank you.
Now we are open for questions.
Yeah. This is a great project, thank you. You said that there's a fast turnaround to share with the community, and I'm curious, what type of platform are you using to share, and is it open just to the community members, or are you opening it up to the public?
So that's a really good question. So the Grass Act project is the best example that I can talk about. So Al Corbier, when he was there, and he and Ted immediately got talking about wanting to do workshops with Ted for maple syrup collecting at a certain time of year and for birch bark collecting. And then Al contacted me fairly soon after coming to say, I need the video materials to start preparing the kids with this stuff, and then Ted will take them out, you know, into the woods and do the work with them. But he wanted to have the video to start editing clips to take into the classroom. And the video that we're using are very, very large files. So what we do is we download everything that was done with the project, and we put it on an external hard drive and ship it out. So unfortunately, it does leave people the other end dealing with software issues and stuff like that, but on the whole, you know, we're just making sure that the data is available. I think as we get more, as Recovering Voices builds the technology's methodology into what we're doing, then we would try and, you know, maybe send more kind of digested pieces. But I kind of feel like, you know, community members on the whole want the whole kit and caboodle. I mean, we sort of, you know, and when we're doing it, we're very much in agreement that, like, all the materials are produced are shared materials. And the idea would also be that Al's going to transcribe it, and so is Rand. But Rand and Marianne are doing a dictionary, so they're like, well, it will be 3 years, which is fair, right? So everyone in that project will have a different sort of turnaround time. But I think Al was really, in a nice way, was like, I just need I need the raw material so that I can figure out what to do with it. So I'm sorry, because I know I didn't give you the platform, but it's like, unfortunately, we're almost like jumping over the platform and just handing them. Yep.
Thank you. It was indeed really nice to see that museums engage in active language documentation in the broader sense, cultural documentation, and the way you showed how useful that can be, that is absolutely convincing. May I ask, what is your strategy with all the tape material that you are doing now, right? That's always a question. Are you going to make that available? Are you storing that? Museums, that is always a question, right? You do cultural preservation,
yeah,
or at least memory of cultural preservation via the preservation of artifacts, of material artifacts, and archives of language documentation do it via digital artifacts.
Yeah.
So we are very similar.
No, it's a really good question.
On different domains. So.
Yeah, I mean, we're really lucky that we have the NAA, we have the National Anthropological Archives just down the corridor. So collections are in one side of this, you know, this museum support center, and then just down the corridor is the archives. So all of that material, you know, will go to the archives. Gina Rappaport, who was here as part of the conference and who was demonstrating certain aspects of the NAA and the projects they're also doing with language revitalization, she and I talk a lot about this because she doesn't want records. Because right now these are active. So if you're using them and the community wants them, or you're engaging with them, or you're going to build some database with them, they're not dead. They're not allowed to go to the archives until they're no longer active. And that they're going to be used for research, not for for sort of ongoing parts of the program. So really, Recovering Voices is going to have to be managing those materials, and then when they're ready to be passed on to the archives, they'll go to the archives. But you know, the Smithsonian encourages us to put them onto these large digital asset management dams. So all the video we have right now gets uploaded onto DAMS, so it's safe, and, you know, we try and keep it current. But, I mean, this is a very new project. I should explain to you, this is very new, and a lot of what we need to do is, in my perspective, is have them transcribe, have them, a lot of them be textual, as well as, you know, having the videos available. But, you know, so we work with the archives, I guess, is the
Yeah, okay, but what I understood from your answer is that you have a very different, and for me, 10 years ago perspective on digital language material. So either it's used in an active project and in community engagement, or it is not used like that anymore, then it can be archived. But, well, the idea of living archives or of what was David Nathan's talk of
progressive
archiving and so on. So this is a very different concept in digital context, right? Material culture, okay, you touch it as little as possible, only when necessary, so that it doesn't deteriorate. But digital materials have to be touched as much as possible.
Right.
So the more it is used, the better it is. And archiving material which is not touched anymore, that is dead. So I think that is a conception that you have to talk with your colleagues over, which we have overcome in the last years, this conference particularly.
Yeah, no, so one of the things we're trying to do is work with various foundations, because a lot of it's to do with funding. The National Anthropological Archives is one of the largest anthropological archives in the world, and it does not have enough people to support the amount of demands on it. So Jean is just realistic when she says to me, if you have this many groups coming in and you're producing this amount of material, you know, it's going to be on, you're going to deal, you know, you're going to have to kind of make it accessible to the communities at this point in time. So, you know, but we're working with foundations and so forth, because one of the things I'm trying to do is come up with a digital access platform where you're able to get objects, botanical specimens, linguistic material, you know, all under a certain kind of tribal title. So whether it's Hopi or Anishinaabe, you know, and right now we don't have that. So for me, like the archiving, we're not even there yet. Right now, it's more like, how do we synthesize the data within the Smithsonian so that people can find it? And that's, I wouldn't even call that archiving. I would just be, that's like a research tool. Mm-hmm. What are the research tools that we need to make this stuff really, you know, workable within all of the communities that are interested? So I kind of feel like archives is like later, once it's all digested. Does that make sense? Like, we still haven't digested the information, so archiving is going to be very secondary. Yeah, go on.
We understand your concept of archiving. Our concept of archiving is different. But that issue now aside, my question is, when you have speakers, are you, like, what kind of metadata are you taking on speakers? Does that travel with those resources, that you, those digital assets that you produce? Or is that, would you say that those cultural observations the speakers are making through those digital assets, are those through the context, right? In this conference, we've learned a lot about context, how important that is to the material produced in those digital assets. Is that being somehow?
You mean, so is there a tagging system so people can find the materials? So
by speaker, if I want to see like all the times that one of the Hopi elders came and talked, and he talked, you know, he came 15 times, but then he talked about maybe 35 different objects, right? So if I want to see, okay, what did a particular elder talk about? Do you have that kind of?
So it's early days. So the absorption of the information hasn't happened yet. Mm-hmm. So when, you know, with the question of like, how do you make this stuff available to the communities? It goes out as a file, as it was recorded, not as what you're saying, this kind of digested, analyzed and tagged event. But, you know, I had an assistant. So the Hopi project was, we started about a year ago, and then GRASSEC was like 3 months ago. So really not that long ago. But with the Hopi project, I funded someone to go in and to annotate what object they were talking about, what time on the tape, you know, what was some of the information. But a lot of times, if it has to be a Hopi speaker that does some of the annotation. So the next level would be to have community members get funded to sit down and add more information. So we would then have a log. But a log is very different from having that connected to your database about the object. So we use a system called EMU in order to find the pot, okay? So you put in the number or, you know, various descriptives, and you find the pot. EMU right now is not really set up to take a huge amount of this kind of information, and certainly it doesn't search according to linguistic terms. So we have lots of conversations about this. So the next level for me is to work with the IT group to develop what they call a field arm. In other words, it's an arm that extends out of EMU. You imagine the size of the Smithsonian. You imagine the size of the collections. I can probably get linguistic fields added to EMU, but it's done through a fairly kind of long consultation process. But really, I don't want to just patch a linguistic field in there. What I really want is what I was saying, is this kind of synthesized database where you're able to see all of that stuff together, where you would have, you know, video.
You want an Omeka presentation.
A what?
An Omeka.
Okay.
Like, it's a CMS that I thought the Smithsonian was part of the sponsoring organization.
Well, you can come up and tell me more about it. The Smithsonian is a bit like the island of Hawaii. So. And each museum is a different town, and you know, you might know some people, but you don't know everybody.
Yeah.
So.
I think our time is off. I'm sorry. Sure, you guys can catch up with Wayne after the presentation. Thank you.